In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with someone who is recognized as being one of America's leading breast cancer researchers. His name is Dr. Edison Liu. He is also currently serving as the executive director of the Genome Institute of Singapore and is professor of medicine at the National University of Singapore. He's spending some time here on the campus as a George A. Miller visiting professor and will be giving a talk in the MillerCom series. That's tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Over the years, we've had a lot of the speakers as part of the series here on this program, so we can bring them to a little bit larger audience, and we're pleased that he could be here and spend a little time with us. He'll be speaking on the topic Science and Technology and the Survival of Humankind. This takes place in the Pollard Auditorium at the Forum of Carle Foundation Hospital on West Park in Urbana. And these programs are always free and open to the public, so certainly anybody who is interested should feel welcome to attend. He's also spent time on the Faculty of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He held faculty appointments in medicine, biochemistry, epidemiology, and genetics, was director of the Specialized Program of Research Excellence in Breast Cancer there, also was co-founder of the Breast Care Center at UNC. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the work that he's done and some of what genomic research can do for us, and talk a little bit about science, technology, and particularly the role of government in promoting science and technology, research and development. And questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, comments, certainly they're welcome. The only thing we ask people to do when they call in is just try to be brief so we can keep moving along. But other than that, questions, comments are welcome. Well, thanks very much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
We appreciate it. Just as a way of starting, I certainly know that you were someone who I'm sure believes very strongly, feels very strongly about the ability of science and technology to yield improvements in human life. I'm sure whenever you get into – or often when you get into discussions like that, I suppose people also want right away to talk about negatives of technology that it doesn't – It hasn't always worked for the best, I guess. And I wonder how it is you, in your mind, you balance those two things, you think about those two things, because you certainly would, you know, you would say, you would acknowledge, well, yes, it's not unreservedly positive science and technology. How do you think about the ups and the downs of that?
Well, it's the simple answer, a simple example would be one of a scalpel. You know, a scalpel in the hands of a skilled surgeon can save lives. At the same time, it's a weapon and used in no different than a sword or a switchblade. So what I'd like to focus on is not just that there is science and technology, but it's really the management and governance of science and technology that is equally important, if not potentially more important, than the activity of science for the benefit of mankind. So in many things that we do, you know, there's really both an upside and a downside. And it's really the decision-making as human beings, as members of society, that really determines whether what we do is for the good or for the negative in humanity.
What here is the appropriate role for government, do you think, in helping to make those decisions about how technology is, what technology we use, how it's developed?
Well, government is really no different than really a form of consensus building and a form of management execution. So one develops a consensus and then executes that consensus. And obviously, the danger of that kind of consensus is mob rule. So there are checks and balances. Our Constitution is a prime example of how those balances have been established. And so government is very important because it's really the umpire in many ways. You use the biggest set of rules, but you always still have to have an umpire in a game, or else the subjective nature of the competitive sport will cause conflict. In many ways, government is, number one, an umpire, a fair broker in the transactions. And second of all, if it's done correctly, then Government is also the consensus builder and in many cases the technology leader because government has a unique capacity to convene. So whenever you have a problem, you convene the experts and have the authority to convene the experts, put together a consensus, and then potentially to execute.
Mm. Well, what happens, though, and I think we've certainly seen examples of that, where you follow that process, you convene your panel of experts, they come up with a consensus, and that for whatever reason, the government decides to ignore it because one cannot completely eliminate politics from the equation.
Well, and that's my point to scientists is that in many situations, scientists being very hard-nosed technology mavens, technology experts, mm-hmm. would view things in a rather narrow view, that the technology is good and therefore it is right. That's not true, mm-hmm. that we don't live in a vacuum. We live in an ethical, religious, social environment that has to take into account the sensibilities of the public. And this is where we have to have politics. It's not bad.
Mm-hmm. How – I think another one of the issues that comes up is the whole business of getting people, getting the public involved in discussions about science and technology. It seems to be difficult, and I don't know if it's because people feel that they just don't have the time, they don't have the background, there aren't the avenues. And it seems that there certainly have been cases where some new bit of technology gets implemented without really very much discussion about its implications. Or maybe, you know, when we do start to get around to talking about it, it's often not a very rational conversation. Do you think that we could do better and how might we do better to get people a little bit more involved in the conversation about science and technology?
Well, I think we should actually define what science and technology is. I think mm-hmm. there is a misperception that is some highfalutin, action by PhDs and researchers. But in actual fact, we work with science and we work with technologies on a daily basis. And it's all around us. And I would say people are doing actually quite well. You know, they vote by their pocketbooks. So when a new technology comes on board, if you don't buy it, the company goes bankrupt and it won't emerge until the time is right. Mm-hmm. It's very few technologies that are actually imposed on us. It's really given to us and then it's a matter of whether or not they're accepted along the way. Now, of course, there are a few that we don't particularly have much control, the nuclear bomb, for example. But there was an imperative that occurred in the World War II that I would argue there was a lot of consensus at that time that it had to be done. Mm-hmm. Now, let me just take it an aside because, sure. again, there is a misperception that science is some very unusual aspect. In actual fact, our entire development as a human race was dependent on applications of what you might call subconscious science. The entire framework of agriculture is a scientific construct. You know, it was the ability to organize the planting season, to do it in rows, to harvest it in an appropriate way, and to find storage capabilities. The activity of salting your meat is a chemical reaction done by trial and error. But it was done nevertheless. That allowed for human beings not to die during winter months, and that allowed for expansion of society. The wheel, the cart, the stirrup was considered a major technologic advance that was initially used in a military fashion by the Mongols. And that's why they were so successful militarily. But that also had ramifications in agriculture as well.
Well, that's interesting. I guess that leads me to think that on the one hand, I think it's often observed that people don't really understand science. That is, they really don't understand how scientists think. They don't really understand. If you said, well, can you tell me what the scientific method is? And a lot of people would say, well, I really don't know. On the other hand, you're saying as part of human history, we've been actually doing it if what you were talking about is making observations about the world, thinking about how things work, trying to understand them, testing, saying, well, I have an idea, maybe it works this way, so let's try and see what happens, which essentially is doing experiments, then gathering data, finding out what works, and then go on from there to implement what you've learned. That really is the scientific method, but maybe people don't really understand that is, in fact, what that is, and that's pretty – it's been a very natural thing, and a lot of the things that we – improvements in human life came about just that very way.
Well, my father-in-law was a farmer, and I would say he was a natural scientist. First of all, he objectively observed. Then he measured how many bushels, you know, per amount of money he put into a seed. Then based on that, he predicted for the next harvest. And so those are fundamentally what scientists do. The only difference perhaps is that we as scientists try to paint a mechanism for a particular function and what have you. Whereas in most people, we don't have the luxury, most non-scientists who function in society don't have the luxury of thinking about mechanisms and tinkering around to figure out mechanisms. For example, why do seeds germinate? You know, that question is not necessarily foremost in farmers' minds, but it's embedded in what they do on a daily basis. Mm.
It seems, though, isn't it, though, the case that at some point in human history, maybe most people, that kind of thing wasn't part of their lives anymore, and that we get this sort of break between people who actually kind of do that for a living, or at least that's what they do, and then the rest of us that just then live with what it is that the people who are the scientists, what it is that they produce.
I think that's the problem, that in actual fact, that is the danger, that we have now abrogated or given up our responsibilities or even the joy of discovery, and saying that, well, we're here only to accept the benefits of science and not really participate in it. And I think that part of that is a sense of inferiority complex, that simply because you don't have a degree in science that you can't participate in. And I disagree intensely. Mm-hmm. We're all scientists, just a matter of degrees. It's the same thing as democracy. You know, at one point, democratic governance systems were considered radical, if you recall, in the 16 and 1700s. But the idea that the common man had enough intelligence to participate in national decision-making was alien to the feudal lords. But of course, this is now standard.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus IBD is Dr. Edison Liu. He's a George A. Miller visiting professor here on the campus of the University of Illinois. He's also director of the Genome Institute of Singapore, has spent a lot of time in his professional career doing research on breast cancer, was for a number of years on faculty of University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's here and spending some time on the campus. We'll be giving this talk on the subject Science and Technology and the Survival of Humankind tomorrow night at 7. This is at the Forum at Carle Foundation Hospital. It's an event in the MillerCom series, and it's open to anybody who is interested in attending. Questions here are welcome, too. We'd like to bring people into the conversation. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers. Somebody up in the northern part of the state in Batavia is the first in line, line number four. Hello.
Yes. Good morning. Good subject. I like the science aspect and everything, but I think it gets a bad rap, especially with NASA and some of the doctors researching some of these medicines for cancer. You know, I've been doing a little bit of research. I think pretty much everybody that you know one or two people that you know will die of cancer in the next couple of years. And I kind of question the science part of this factor. I know there's all sorts of cancers. My father just passed away with lung cancer. But the thing that I'm puzzled about is this stem cell research. I think, honestly, we need to look at this. I know a lot of people are dead set against this. But then when you see people suffer the way they do, not having the kind of research – kind of puzzles me on the science end of it. I know scientists, you know, should be able to control, you know, what part of the science aspect or you'd be studying in this. But, you know, it just seems to me more people are dying of cancer every year than ever before. And I kind of wonder if, you know, I want your comment on this. Is there a big push for cancer research? It seems like there's a lot of money going there, but I don't see anything coming out. Is there a big push for this, or is it just kind of like a stalemate with other things? Thanks. I'll get off.
All right.
Well, you actually asked a question that is really at the heart of what I've been working on and with for many years, both as a scientist and as a critic and as a physician. Let me just tell you that there is no question that there has been dramatic advancements in the treatment and cure of cancers. There are many diseases, from leukemias to testicular cancers, lymphomas to now breast cancer and other cancers, whereby just when I was in high school, if I had those cancers, I would be dead. Whereas the probability of cure is 50%, 60%, 80%. That's pretty dramatic, very, very dramatic. So it is totally true that we've made significant advances in cancer. What's even more important is that once you have cancer, 50 years ago, you would have been subjected to what we now know as mutilating surgery, because that was the only tool we had. But now we have the fastest growing population in medicine is really cancer survivors. And these are individuals with cancers that would have caused their demise, their death earlier on. But they're now not only surviving the cancer, but they're living full and productive lives with their disease. So I would also say that all the advances were due to both a basic scientific understanding of cancers and also the clinical trials that followed. Just a quick example is that in the last 10 years, our technologies have brought us to a point where we can pinpoint the precise genetic mutations in any individual cancer. And in fact, our therapies are directed against those individual mutations. So the day of actually very much personalized medicine, that is medicine directed specifically at your cancer, is really becoming a reality.
And is this, would you say we would expect to see, again, significant advances within the next, what, 5-10 years?
We already had significant advances in the last 20 years, but I would say that the advances are really accelerating. There are a few diseases that are unusual that, quite frankly, were completely incurable. Now with a single pill, you can control those cancers. Now, one of the problems with cancer is not one disease. It is many, many diseases. It's sort of like saying, have we found a cure for death? You know, the truth of the matter is I don't think we do, nor will we ever. But the conversion of early death, which was a case at the turn of the century in 1900s. By the way, the life expectancy of an American at 1900 was 48 years old. Now it's in 78 years old. So I would say we've made significant advances in general, but in particular, specific advances in cancer.
I'd like to maybe ask a couple of other questions, but I do have another caller here, so I can come back to my questions when we get to them in Urbana here, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. What I have is a small thing, but the Mongols didn't invent the stirrup. It was invented about 1,000 years earlier by the Scythians, an Indo-Iranian people who inhabited the southern steppes from the Danube to probably near Western China. Modern Western China, and they invented it. They were known for their tactic of riding away from an advancing army and then standing in their saddles and in their stirrups and firing a volley of arrows back at the advancing troops. So just a small thing, but these misattributions have a way of becoming long-lived.
Well, if I can answer that, I think you're totally correct. I certainly the invention may have been with the Scythians, because that's a point of argument even amongst anthropologists. But mm-hmm. nevertheless, they are steppe peoples.
Oh, very much so.
Of which the Mongols actually adopted their techniques and put it into industrial scale, with huge consequences, as you well know. And the Chinese then took over and converted the stirrup into a cast iron industry rather than forging. So it's another example of diffusion of science and technology. I totally agree with you, by the way. I apologize for that misattribution. But it is quite clear that of the people who actually it's sort of like saying who invented MRI or the TV, but who really actually now makes TVs, you know? Mm-hmm. Quite frankly, it's maybe the Scythians invented it, but the people who really industrialized it were really a little eastward, which is...
It's a fine example of how these technologies are initiated in one area and then another people or area picks them up and further perfects them, and they're passed down through mankind. And
I think that what you're painting here is really reminding us that the transfer of technology becomes critical for the survival of humanity. As you know, one of the problems that I've seen in later science in China was this clannish framework where a clan would hide their discoveries, and when the clan died, the whole technology died, and that was true for some of the ceramics that were there. This is one of the reasons why patenting has become a major part of it. Part of the patenting is the disclosure of the technology, but protected disclosure, so that the technology can be ultimately distributed. And so distribution of scientific knowledge is critical.
Well, thank you. I'm enjoying your talk.
Right, thank you very much for that point.
To return to the conversation we were having before about cancer and in response to the first caller, what can one say about competition for however much research money there is among different fields? And within medicine, for example, we have people who work on different sorts of things, cancer, diabetes, you know, what heart disease, what have you. So they have to compete for the money. And then there are all kinds of different science. There's only so much, seems like there's only so much money for scientific research. So the people who are the high energy physicists are competing with the cancer researchers, or competing with the astronomers who were, you know, you take my point that people have to compete for a finite source of research dollars. How does that money get divvied up, and what are some of the problems associated with that?
Well, this is the reason why I make a big point of governance and management. You mm-hmm. know, science is like art. You know, it's boundless because the creativity of humanity is theoretically boundless. The question is then valuation. You know, how do you define valuation? Should one body define what is important, or should be a democratic process? And I think luckily for us in the United States, it is a democratic process. It's messy. There will be conflicts, but sooner or later, there's an equilibrium about what is important and what isn't. Now, we have two countervailing forces in making our decisions in biomedical research, less so in engineering, let's just say. One is the burden of disease, you know. If a disease causes only a disorder in one in a million, one could argue let's put more money in more common disorders. But the balancing act in this is that a lot of times the rare disorders are precisely the ones that give us the understanding of the mechanism of disease. Hmm. So let's put some money where we can really understand the mechanisms, because by understanding the mechanisms, we can generalize to more common disorders. So as a scientific a funder of science, which was my role at the National Cancer Institute, this was the type of decision-making that we had to make. The balance between the burden of disease, the most people that would be affected by our research, and the scientific opportunities with rare disorders that can give us really profound understanding of the mechanisms of disease.
Yeah. How though it seems that here now the difficulty is that then someone will have to persuade people that the way that we have chosen to allocate the funds is appropriate. And I'm sure that if people are touched by if we're talking about funding for research in particular in disease and human health, that we're always going to have people that if they have a particular concern for themselves, for a family member, that it's there's almost never going to be enough of attention given to condition A because I have it or my children have it or my parents have it or my brothers and sisters, that you're always going to have to be saying to people that, well, yes, it's certainly important and we can understand this, but maybe you ought to think about how we should put the money into something else or put some of the money into something else. I mean, it seems, you know, for the individual, it's always going to be centered, understandably, centered on their experience.
But isn't that the fundamental transaction in any community, in any society? Mm-hmm. You get a tribe living together, and at some point you're going to have to say, how do we divvy up this animal we slaughtered, you know? Who's going to get the leg and who's going to get the ribs? This is fundamental to living as a community. The key, though, is in that argument, in that process of negotiation, that we don't kill each other for it. That there is a process whereby there is a rational discourse. There is a decision that is made, and the decision may not be irrevocable, but is one that we need to follow through for a period of time to see if it works. And if it doesn't work, let's change that process.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. I have a caller we'll get right to. I'd like to introduce once again our guest, Dr. Edison Liu. He's a George A. Miller visiting professor here at University of Illinois. He's director of the Genome Institute of Singapore, spent a number of years on the faculty of UNC, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's a breast cancer researcher. That's his particular area of interest, study, expertise. He's giving a talk in the MillerCom series on the subject Science and Technology and the Survival of Humankind. And that's tomorrow night at 7 in the Pollard Auditorium at the Forum as part of Carle Foundation Hospital. And these events are always open to the public. So if you're interested, you can hear what he has to say. And questions on the show are welcome too, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Champaign. And this is line number one. Hello.
Good morning, David. Good morning, Dr. Liu. I'm curious to know the attitude of someone who's working in the basic research side of genetics to the applications of that research, how it's brought to the treatment side and through application. And I'm particularly interested in this notion of patenting life, patenting novel combinations of genes. That seems to subject life to the logic of a market, and that those two things don't always really work very well together. The specific example I'm thinking of is BT corn, which is Bacillus thuringiensis produces a toxin that kills a number of pests that are harmful to a wide variety of crops. It was a great boon to most all farmers and organic farmers in particular who have refrained from using chemical methods, especially because the toxin that the BT organism produces breaks down very quickly. So it gets in, does the job, gets out. But the new genetically modified plants that have had genes from that bacteria inserted into their genome produce this toxin continuously, which now makes it, you know, a pervasive, consistent genetic pressure on the populations of the pests that it's designed to control, which, as we've seen with so many other, you know, chemicals, some of which have been hailed as wonder drugs, evolution very quickly makes them irrelevant by adapting the targeted population. And when people have brought this up to the companies that did this, they say, oh, well, we'll just find another one. Well, I mean, when you're only, you know, recombining existing genetic material into novel combinations, how many interesting combinations are you going to find? There are going to be many, many out there, but if you're using them up like this in order to meet the demands of industrialized agriculture in this case, I don't know how quickly you're going to be able to stay ahead of the bugs. That's just one particular example, and it's not really in your field. I'm not sure it really has too much application to breast cancer, but I'm very curious especially about the attitude of a basic genetic researcher towards the applications of that research. Mm-hmm. And I'll hang up and take my answer up here. Thank you very much.
All right.
You humble me with your knowledge in agricultural molecular biology. Let me just say that despite my billing as a breast cancer researcher, in the last 10 years or so, I've really taken on a perhaps much broader role in genomic sciences and on a national scale and international scale in both in Singapore and now as the president of the Human Genome Organization. So we do worry about these issues. I've generalized much more from breast cancer itself. So let me just address the two major questions that you have. First of all, basic genetics. There is sometimes a misperception, certainly not from the caller, but amongst a lot of very intelligent lay people, that genetics is something that is only transmitted from mother to daughter, father to son. That is, it's hereditable. But in actual fact, every cellular function is genetically based because every cell takes orders from its nucleus and from its DNA, of which a portion of it, of course, the imprint is passed on a heritable manner. But in terms of cancers, there's basically fundamentally mutation that takes place, and that then becomes a cancer, but it is not passed on. So there's what we call somatic mutations. Furthermore, all aspects of biotechnology is based on a genetic framework. Your erythropoietin, your GM-CSF, all the insulin that you're taking now is done by recombinant DNA work, which is genetic in nature. You take a gene, put it into a different organism, pump out milligram and kilogram quantities of it, package it, and that's what we use. So the role of genetics in all of biology and all of medicine is here to stay. It's sort of like if we were to turn it back, it would be sort of like saying, well, let's do transportation now, but let's ban all combustible engines. It's just not feasible to do that. The issue about genetic research, which is heritable, is really a serious one because when we identify a genetic disorder, it has ramifications not only in terms of the patient, but all the patient's children as well, because obviously 50% of the children will carry an imprint from one of the parents. And if there is a genetic disorder, then statistically 50% will carry that abnormal gene. And so a diagnosis in the patient has ramifications in the children itself, the future of the children. So we're very careful. We've spent many years arguing and debating how best to do that kind of diagnostic so to minimize the psychological and social damage that could be passed on to the children. Your other question about patenting life is really a critical one. I can tell you that the patent laws or the patent regulations have changed dramatically since the beginning of recombinant DNA to now. At one point, you could patent genes by themselves, just by the sequence itself. Now, that's not feasible, and I think that that's a good move. And you're totally correct in terms of the concern about patenting something that is inherent in all of us. And let me just say that the patent legal system and governments are cognizant or are aware of that problem. But like every other problem that deals with ethics, it's not a simple solution to the end of it. Lastly, your issue about the combinations. In actual fact, the combinatorial biology gives you potentially infinite possibilities for solutions, not limit you. In fact, it increases your capabilities. The idea that we will have to constantly stay ahead of the game from our competitors, which are you know, detrimental to our crops, is precisely in medicine what we do with antibiotics. We are constantly having to deal with the genetic changes in our bacteria and our viruses, and this is life. This is what evolution is all about, and what we're doing right now is to stay ahead of the evolutionary game in antibiotics.
Mm. Well, although isn't it also the case that in that particular example, because of the development of antibiotics and their widespread use, increasingly widespread use, it's getting harder and harder for us to stay ahead. And it's because of – and it is in part because of our science and technology. And I suppose some people would raise this question, well, one of the problems with the technology is that sometimes we identify a problem, we identify a technology to solve the problem, but the solution comes with some side effects. And that maybe then we end up creating a new problem and then we say, oh, well, we'll create some new technology to solve that problem. Mm-hmm. And I guess there are some people who are critical of the kind of way of thinking that says technology can solve any problem that technology creates.
So let me answer that in two ways. Technology did solve a problem, but what you're talking about in antibiotic resistance, first of all, is inevitable in that once you put something on board, the organisms will seek to find resistance to it. But what you talked about were the abuses of the antibiotic use, which is a management problem. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with the technology. It has to do with, you know, potentially the silliness of the management. Okay, this is why I keep coming back to the framework that science and technology is not your enemy. It's a tool. But our enemy is ourselves, you know. Mm-hmm. When a father or mother brings a child to the doctor and the doctor says, I won't give you antibiotics because it's not good for society, what will you do? Will you scream and shout and say, it's my son and daughter who's ill, you must give them the antibiotics? Or will you accept that? Because quite frankly, that is the choice. Mm-hmm. That is the choice. Now, we talk about, you know, maybe going back to when there were no vaccinations. I know there are people who don't like to be vaccinated, and there are people who say the antibiotics are evil. But understand that in 1900, the reason for the life expectancy to be 47 and 48 was precisely, exclusively, because of early death, because of infectious diseases. Now, we have a choice as a society. We can go back to that. And in fact, that's what we're all fearing right now, is that once antibiotic-resistant bugs become prevalent in the world, we're going to fall back to the 1900s where there were no antibiotics.
Well, then I guess that gets us back to perhaps it's people's attitudes, their expectations, who shapes those, how people communicate with their physicians. What it is they ask for, what it is that they expect. What do you do about that? I mean, for example, to take the example of us, you know, you have people who have a sick child and you go to the doctor and maybe you have some expectations about what should happen. And the doctor says, I think that's not the way to go and this is the way we should go. You know, how do you talk to people about being in that very situation and get them to accept the fact, you know, when they say, look, the child needs an antibiotic, and the doctor says, no, actually, you don't, and we got this problem with antibiotics, and let me even try to explain to you what the problem is. You know, how do you get people to accept a message like that?
It's very difficult. It is the crux in the nature of being human, of communicating mm-hmm. and being in a community. Now, by the way, there are no magic bullets to this. It's true for everything that we do from, you know, for example, microeconomics and macroeconomics. What do you get people to pay for or not pay for are big issues. But there are just specifically this antibiotic issue. There are I think there are multifaceted solutions. First of all, an understanding to doctors that they have a national role to play in protecting the future patients from antibiotic-resistant bugs. The second is perhaps educating the public that, you know, taking antibiotics isn't without its side effects. There are serious allergic reactions that take place in populations because of the antibiotics. Mm-hmm. That's usually not explained or known to many patients as well. So that they're part of the balancing act as well. The third is, well, you know, in our economists tell us that if people pay for what they ask for, they think twice about what they ask. And perhaps we need to start thinking about the economic balances that actually take place to allow to encourage people to make the right decisions. And then the fourth is that there are technologic solutions to this. For example, what if we had a diagnostic that in the doctor's lab, a doctor's office, I can say to you, yes, indeed, you have a bug that antibiotics can treat, or no, you don't have that. Mm-hmm. Okay. To be frank with you, those technologic solutions are feasible. Just so happens that the economics don't encourage companies to develop that. And sometimes the regulatory framework slows it down as well. So again, there are solutions. There are social solutions. There are legislative solutions. And there are technologic solutions that we can actually bring to bear.
We have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit less, in this hour of Focus 580 with Dr. Edison Liu. He's currently a Miller visiting professor on the campus. He's director of the Genome Institute of Singapore. He's a physician, has done work both in cancer research and also in genomic medicine research. Questions, welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that here as we get down to our last 5 or 6 or 7 minutes, I'd like to have you talk a little bit about Singapore and the experience in Singapore. And because at several points, you know, we've come back to this point of what should the role of government be in trying to direct research and regulate research, trying to set priorities as a funder and so forth. Do you think that has the government in Singapore done something that you think can serve as a model for us in the United States or for other governments?
I think that to a certain extent, yes. But you need to know that all of the world looks to the U.S. as a model for how science and technology has been successful. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, I think that there are certain lessons that we can learn from Singapore that is unique to Singapore. But, you know, we're moving towards some of those stresses. Let me explain that. First of all, Singapore is a country with no natural resources whatsoever. It imports 40% of its water, all its food, all its building material. It has literally nothing on the ground that you can actually pull out. So you can ask, why is it successful? It's successful for primarily two reasons. One is geographic location as a way station for sea commerce. But the second and most important is its unique management of human resources within its own population of literally only 4 million people. Okay. Now, because of that, it's sort of like, what kind of governance do you have in a big city of 4 million versus a rowboat where you're trying to survive in a rolling seas? Do you then have every rower raise their hand and say, we turn left or we turn right? No. And that's their argument, that things are just a little too precarious. And so the role of government in Singapore is much more intense than the role of government in the United States. And there, issues around education, taxation, health, even the formulation of a research agenda is done much more centrally. But at the same time, with great respect to experts within the field and with consensus building in a small community, again, the advantage is a small community in a small space. So consensus can actually be drawn in much faster route. Mm-hmm. In Singapore, we don't have the luxury of letting everybody experiment, every professor experiment with whatever they want to do. There is a general guideline to saying that, you know, that these are the areas where we think is most important for the country. And will you participate? And if you don't, you're welcome to leave. But if you stay, then there is an expectation that we work together towards some common benefit.
Yeah. Well, I'll leave aside the fact that some people might have concerns about Singapore and the involvement of the government in people's lives. But if we say talk about a country like the United States, where there is this very high level of expectation of individual decision making, people deciding what kind of research they're going to do and try to go out and get the money to do it, and have a very high, you know, have this maybe sometimes not very well informed and not very disciplined public debate about what we should be doing. How is there any way that you could get a little bit more of that? I mean, given that we have those kinds of expectations, that's what the kind of country this is. I mean, is there some way to get the government more productively involved and at the same time respect and, you know, acknowledge that you're going to have to live with a certain level of chaos that comes with the democracy that we believe in here?
Well, I think that to be totally frank, that the Singapore experience wouldn't work well here. And I think the reverse is what I think we're arguing, that mm-hmm. the American experience, which is exported throughout the world, doesn't work in many jurisdictions. Simply because America is so big, so rich, so diverse, that you can make mistakes and not only survive from it, but learn from it. Okay, in a small environment and with limited resources like Singapore, each mistake has cataclysmic consequences. So they tend, for whatever reason, to be a much more planned society. And that's the case in many other countries. My only point is, let's not disparage those models. Let's respect that there are different constraints that people have. Now, you ask what kind of discipline, you know, can we put in the U.S. decision making. Mm-hmm. To be frank with you, you know, in science, like in art, you put too much discipline and you lose the beauty of the discovery process. Yeah. And so consequently, I don't have a set point that is appropriate for the U.S. I do think that there are some very intelligent people arguing the case pro and con for more control. My only hope, however, is not necessarily in the scientific community, but perhaps in the public to engage the population in the U.S. and to say that you're scientists as well. You have a say in the debate, just as much as what has happened in disease research, that the advocates, the breast cancer advocates, the AIDS advocates, changed the equation from one that only scientists decided what was to be studied to make it a more democratic process to say, scientists, you're doing some good work, but hey, your work has to have an impact on my life as well.
We have a couple of minutes left. I do have a caller here we wanted to bring in Champaign, I believe, and line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've got a couple of observations I want to make. One is that I've had a couple of physicians tell me that people are becoming resistant to antibiotics. Now, I explained to these people that bacteria are becoming resistant to antibiotics. But what he said tells me he doesn't have the vaguest idea of what's going on, that the bacteria are evolving, and that the more we use, the more frequently we use these antibiotics, the faster that evolution goes. Now, I'm very conscious of that because I'm an entomologist. And we had that experience beginning back in 1946, 2 years after we started using DDT, houseflies were resistant to it. And we quickly learned that the solution, one of the solutions to the problem, at least to slow down the development of the resistance, is to use as little insecticide as possible. And that lesson does not seem to have been carried over into medicine.
Well, I appreciate the comment. Any comment you want to make on that?
Well, you know, I totally agree with you. Now, again, the problem is the decision making. You know, it's very hard, and it's not the technology. It's really what you decide, or what the government, what the regulatory agents, what the experts decide to do with their DET. There's no question that anytime you introduce anything, we must understand that the idea that we can introduce some perturbation in the environment, that it will not change the environment through an evolutionary process, is just not realistic. The issue here is, can we introduce something into the environment, into the environment, that would minimize the downside of that change? So by introducing DDT, sooner or later, you're going to get a resistance to take place. But will it be 1 year, 10 years, or 100 years depends on your use of this process.
We are going to have to stop. And I can say, though, for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear some more from our guest, Dr. Edison Liu, he'll be speaking on the topic Science and Technology and the Survival of Humankind. This is an event in the MillerCom series, and over the years we've been happy to have a lot of MillerCom speakers here on the program. This is taking place tomorrow night at 7 o'clock in the Pollard Auditorium at the Forum. That's part of Carle Foundation Hospital on West Park in Urbana. These events, they're always free and open to the public, so anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. Our guest, Edison Liu, is currently George A. Miller Visiting Professor at the U of I. He's also director of the Genome Institute of Singapore. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it.